This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota. Most of us are spending a lot more time at home than we used to. Perhaps one benefit of being homebound is a return to home cooking and local flavors. Today, Sarah Aronson, host of Montana Public Radio's The Right Question, visits with Yellowstone Public Radio's Stella Fong about her new cookbook, Flavors Under the Big Sky. Fong's book pays tribute to her Chinese-American heritage and the advantages of eating locally.
Stella, you have a radio show, Flavors Under the Big Sky, and I was hoping you could just talk a little bit about the program itself and how it came to be.
Flavors Under the Big Sky, celebrating the bounty of the region, came as, I would say, a blessing. I think the planets were aligned and it just came to be. We talk about the great things we have in our very own backyards. I have been able to talk to producers and ranchers and chefs and cooks and restaurateurs and just really anything about food. And I just feel like I have learned so much from our community. It started with my Historic Restaurants of Billings book. We have our very own personality and we should be proud of it.
In the foreword by Chuck Schomer, he writes, "In cooking, a person is only limited by their imagination." And I was hoping you could walk us into that sentiment from your perspective.
Food is one of those ingredients that I think allow people to, one, talk to each other and communicate with each other. It's also an ingredient that you in the kitchen can bring together in almost any way that you want to make it delicious, to make it presentable. But it takes a little bit of that sensing of what is that food and what can I do with it? And Chuck has always been a mentor to me. You know, moving here 20 years ago, I wasn't familiar with all the game and the bounty that we had here. Once I was introduced to that, that imagination could come out because I found that I could use the ingredients that I found here for many of the recipes that I had grown up with or I was familiar with.
Oh, this is a great segue. Let's go to your background. Stella, I was hoping that you would start by reading a bit from your introduction.
My Chinese background. I do not recall deep conversations with my Chinese-born parents. My father and mother expressed the care and love they held for my siblings and me through food. They were unable to express their emotions in any other way. My aunt stuffed us with cakes and dumplings rather than filling our heads with the worries of the world. When my relatives greeted one another near dinner time, they would ask, "Have you eaten rice?" instead of, "How are you doing?" My father, Mankin, immigrated to Hong Kong from Canton, China in the early 1950s after the communists founded the People's Republic of China. As a high school teacher, my father knew he would be challenged as an educated individual and slipped out from the South to start a new life in Hong Kong. He left before his mother. Weeks later, she packed some clothes into a shopping bag and departed in the dark of night to join her son in Hong Kong. My husband, Joe, and I took my parents to visit my father's home in the late 1990s, 40 years after he left it. When the Chinese took over his family's property, they confiscated the family's lychee fields but left the house alone. For years, it remained in the possession of a cousin. She kept the key and left the house as it was. Two padlocked doors secured the space, about the size of a large garage. About half an inch of dust covered the floor. What was left behind remained mostly untouched all those years. My father's childhood books remained in the bookcase. In the kitchen, by the sink, a dish rack held chopsticks and overturned rice bowls. My father was the youngest of 11 children, 4 girls and 7 boys. He had the opportunity to be with his mother and helped her cook. Dad brought the love of food and cooking to our family. My father met my mother, Chol Mun, in Hong Kong, where she was teaching kindergarten. In the 3 years they courted before they married, they laid the plans to relocate to the United States. They landed on Gold Mountain, the name given to America in Chinese, in San Francisco in 1956. While my mother had to learn how to cook the basics when she first arrived, my father cured duck, fried whole fish, and stir-fried crabs. He dried beef jerky, flavored with soy sauce, sesame oil, and brown sugar directly on the racks of our gas oven. He invented concoctions with boxed mashed potatoes with curry powder and incorporated Spam into fried rice and steamed eggs. Working in a grocery store, Dad had access to the many new food products, so I grew up with instant breakfast drink combined with Chinese rice porridge and instant oatmeal mixed with mushroom soup and green onions. In this cookbook, I share a few recipes inspired by my father's culinary curiosity.
What makes cooking and food a natural ingredient for love?
I think food brings comfort to people, and food brings people together. So it is one of those that I think it brings emotions. It brings comfort when you're sad. It brings joy and celebration when you're happy. And it is something that, for my family, brought us all together because, again, as I said, I don't remember us having conversations. And it was just the way our family was. So we communicated through food. And my parents showed me their love through food. I can remember coming home from college and my parents would insist on taking me to our favorite family dim sum or dumpling place. Or my mother would insist that my dad would make my favorite noodles or the favorite dish. Food just is that neutral platform ingredient that just easily brings people together.
Stella, in part one, you incorporate some of these recipes and parts of your heritage to the Montana table. And I was hoping actually you could just start by explaining the magic of five spice powder.
The magic of five spice powder. Five spice powder just has, is it personality? Is it just the structure? It's one of those spices that it has spice from Szechuan peppercorns, but it's spice in the way that it numbs your tongue. So it almost like puffs up your tongue a little bit. Star anise, that's usually that licorice-y flavor that is in this spice powder that is, I think, the main backbone, the main personality, I'm using that word again, of this spice. And then you have cloves, which is that warm spice. Cinnamon, again, one of those warm spices. And, you know, as Americans, we think of, you know, cinnamon and cloves like in pumpkin pie and Thanksgiving and holidays. And then fennel seeds, anise, it kind of, again, stands in the background of that star anise. But star anise really is, I'm going to say, the star of this five spice powder. And the reason I put this powder together is that we certainly can go to the store and buy the spices. I have the recipe for it because my husband actually doesn't like the star anise as much. So I lessened it a little bit more as maybe compared to some other combination. So again, in the book, there are these recipes for the curry powder, for instance, but it's because I wanted to make my own combination. And also early on, five spice powder wasn't available on the shelf of the grocery store or as readily available as it is now.
In your recipe, roast duck with steamed buns, you write, "Duck has always been my favorite red meat. I love chicken cooked every which way, and duck is just like a cross between chicken and beef." And when I read that, I thought, oh, that's the best explanation of duck I've heard. What do you tell those folks who might be intimidated about cooking duck?
To actually not be intimidated. I think it's because most people aren't familiar with it. I think duck is that combination of beef and maybe a chicken breast. So it's that combination, and you do have to pay attention to cooking that piece of beef because you can overcook it. You can do the same thing with a piece of chicken. So it's that familiarity, buying the ingredient, and just going for it and, you know, cooking with it. And again, you know, this recipe, actually, you mentioned both beef and chicken. You could substitute that for this in a different way by using the marinade and then cooking it up and grilling it or grilling it up.
What kind of a steamer do you recommend for making steamed buns?
I love using a bamboo steamer. It just imparts that slight bamboo-y essence to the bun itself. But, you know, if you're cooking for a crowd, many of the stores have the aluminum steamers, and you certainly could create your own steamer. You know, you can have a big wok and then put in a heat-proof plate and elevate it above water.
How do you integrate the fancy or finer points of indoor dining with the outdoor life?
It's funny how we tend to draw lines on that. And I always think that we think things are special because we don't have access to it. It's one of those that, you know, someone who has lived in Montana and maybe buy a ditch, you know, a water ditch, they just get asparagus every year. They can go out and they can just pick it. For them, it's like, oh, well, we're just going to go out and pick asparagus this year. Or there may be morel mushrooms around because they're around it. Because I grew up in the city and I didn't have access readily to asparagus that was just growing out in the wild, I see it as really special. And because I didn't have access to morels, I see it as something really to be honored and looked at as a really special ingredient. So that fine line sometimes is, I think, defined by us, because I think all foods are good and all foods are special, but it's how we define it to be. And they don't necessarily have to be defined, I think.
Will you also describe your backpacking recipe for trout? This blew my mind.
Oh, what I would do when I was backpacking, I will admit that I haven't been in the last several years. I will take aluminum foil, and then I will take bulb of garlic with me. And sometimes I will just take a ginger root also, and I will bring along some soy sauce. And if I have room, I'll bring along some sesame oil. Of course, they've been transferred into smaller containers. And if you catch a trout and you have a fire going, you literally can just put the trout in that foil with all the goodies and just stick it in the fire itself. You open up the foil and the fish is cooked.
Can you tell us about Prairie Surprise Cowboy Cookies?
This recipe came about because Dr. Florence Dunkel invited me to judge one of her bug buffet or her bug cook-offs. She's been an advocate of eating insects for years and years and years. And she introduced me to eating insects, the health benefits, the benefits to our own land and protecting it. I wanted to bring together all these great ingredients for making cookies, and also something that you could just pack up and it would have a lot of calories, it would have protein that you can either take for a long run, or you happen to be going on a horseback ride or on a backpack trip. Gives you some zip, gives you energy, gives you protein, and just gives you some strength to just move on.
One of the things I noticed reading this book is that there are a lot of meat recipes. And in the book, you actually make a note, when you eat at home with your husband, you usually eat vegan and vegetarian. And I was wondering if you would be so kind as to share, what are some of your favorite go-to vegan and vegetarian meals, just the two of you?
We love the salads in here. Radish, cherry, asparagus salad is probably one of my favorites, but that, I think, encapsulates what I like to do a lot. It is whatever is available, whatever is in season, I will try to bring it together, because the seasons change and they fluctuate and things ripen and they go out of season. You know, instead of cherries, I could maybe throw in peaches when they come into be, or if there happen to be raspberries, those can go in. So in many ways, that's somewhat how we eat. And the pestos that I have in the book, they will go on a fish or a piece of chicken and get baked up, or they will get stirred up in a pasta. There are vegetarian, vegan options in this book that I find that we do more on a regular basis.
I was most drawn to your rose hip baklava and the basil vegan chocolate cake. And do you remember how you stumbled upon those specific flavors for those recipes?
The rose hips and chocolate. You know, roses and chocolate have always been that romantic combination, you know, for Valentine's Day or for those date nights. And so the rose hips also came about because when I hiked in the Sierras, when I lived in California, I would see rose hips, and they would always be like a gift that I would find during those hikes. I would always pick them and I would cook with them. But then I thought that the chocolate and rose combination was like the perfect romantic kind of fun combination. These muffins do. They just have, I don't know, they just have a certain romance in them. As far as the basil vegan chocolate cake, I've been making this chocolate cake. We've been vegan for maybe 10 years or so. I mean, I call ourselves convegan because I cannot pass up on good food. And plus, I'm in the food business. So when we're at home, we'll eat mostly vegan, mostly vegetarian. But when I go out and someone is honoring me with an invitation to dinner, I am not going to turn that down because I feel blessed that I am at their table. So I've been making this vegan chocolate cake for years and years. So, you know, some years I'd add, you know, a little bit extra, maybe cinnamon. I'll add some coconut flakes or maybe some nuts. And I found that there was this, the chocolate and basil to me is also one of those kind of romantic, flavorful combinations of summer. And especially with the Thai basil, it has a little bit more of that bite of cinnamon in there. So it just kind of goes together, I think, with it.
The book is divided up geographically, and in the chapter titled Plains, you wrote this: "I want to pay homage to what I first overlooked when I moved here." And you've mentioned a little bit about, you know, sometimes we're blind to the bounty that's all around us, or morels, you know, don't seem so special, or huckleberries maybe don't seem so special when we get to live among them. But I'm really curious, how has your experience of the Montana food life shifted over the years in terms of what you can access naturally?
It's shifted in the sense that I think what happens is many times we move to places and we think that what we had before was better. And partly it's maybe we were afraid of trying new or not opening our eyes to what is right in front of us because we miss what has been our past. And again, I noticed that when I was doing research for historic restaurants at Billings, is that the railroad brought in a lot of items on the menu because I think the people who moved here missed the oysters and they missed the seafood and they weren't embracing maybe the meats as much, you know, even though they appeared on the menu. So we miss these things and we need to bring them along to hold our hands for a while until we move on to what is right in front of us and what we can embrace and live with. So the journey has been that I have learned that there are just really great things here. And I believe that the cultural eating scene has also embraced that. Chefs are finding that. Farmers markets are also bringing items that were maybe more naturally available here than trying to reproduce what's on, you know, the New York side of the world or the California side of the world, that things are good here, that there are berries and mushrooms and asparagus that we've talked about before and meat that's available that's absolutely delicious.
As we know, the pandemic has really shifted our relationship with food and dining out, and restaurants have been hit pretty hard. What is your hope for the home chef and for the restaurant industry?
Wow. My hope for the home chef is that during this time, we learn that cooking does bring family together, that there are ingredients that I would say ground us. It makes us go in the kitchen and create food that nourishes and nurtures us and our families. And, you know, when you could have from friends over, that the chefs also see that, that they honor what is in front of them.
Sarah Aronson, host of Montana Public Radio's The Right Question, visited with Yellowstone Public Radio's Stella Fong, author of Flavors Under the Big Sky, Recipes and Stories from Yellowstone Public Radio and Beyond. Fong also hosts a monthly show on Yellowstone Public Radio. You can find it at ypradio.org. Next on Main Street, Natural North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
There's a night 50 years ago that Nina Fuller still can't understand. If you ask her what she thinks she should have done, she knows the answer.
I walk out and I get in my car and I drive home. Definitely. But that's not what I did.
Why our own behavior can be mystifying, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
That's tonight at 8 Central here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chuck Lura has a broad knowledge of natural North Dakota. Since 2005, Chuck has written a weekly column, Naturalist at Large, for several North Dakota newspapers. Chuck retired as a biology professor at Dakota College at Bottineau, where he published research on ecological aspects of grasslands in the northern Great Plains. Today, he offers insights about milkweed and the bees.
Many years ago, I took a garbage bag and set out to collect some flowers of the common milkweed for my botany labs. I found a good patch of the milkweeds and proceeded to cut off the flower heads, letting them drop in the bag. When I had collected enough flower heads, I tied up the bag and put it in a prep room freezer for safekeeping. Later, when I opened them up in lab, several dead and frozen bees dropped out from amongst the flowers. They apparently had been working the milkweed flowers. I quickly noticed that many of these bees had little yellow saddlebag-like structures with two pollen sacs or pollinia attached to their legs. Some plants have evolved interesting mechanisms to help ensure pollination, and the common milkweed is a case in point. If you've ever looked closely at the flowers of a milkweed, they're different. We'll bypass a full explanation of the flower structure, but the casual observer will notice five hoods. They'll look something like modified and folded petals pointing upward and outward. These hoods surround the male and female reproductive structure, which is in the center. If you look at the flower from the side, you'll notice between the hoods is a small vertical slit with a small ridge on each side. If there's a little dark spot, a gland, above that slit, the pollinia, or little saddlebags of yellow pollen, are still in place. If a bee or other insects alight on the flower, there's a good chance that one of their legs will slide down the side of the flower between the hoods. And there's also a good chance that one of the many hairs on the bee's legs will slip into the slit. The flower and slit is structured so that when the bee pulls up its leg, it'll likely pull up the pollinia. The whole structure resembles a very small wishbone with a pollinia at the bottom of each branch. If all goes well for the milkweed, the bee will fly to another milkweed flower, slip its leg over the slide, and slip that pollen into one of those slits, breaking it off, and thus pollinate the flower. Job done. Cross-pollinated. The next generation will soon be on its way. If the common milkweeds are not flowering near you already, they will be soon. If you get the opportunity, check out these flowers. They're quite intriguing. Plus, you may be able to lift out those little pollinia with a small pin or needle. I put a link to the Natural Resource Conservation Service note on milkweed pollination, along with a text of this Natural North Dakota. You can access it at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, a Harvest Public Media report about pandemic relief for farmers and ranchers, and an online discussion group for parents coping with the pandemic will be authored by Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Blue Flint Ethanol is continuing its efforts to find new fuel and power sources. The plant is co-located with Great River Energy's Coal Creek Power Plant, which is scheduled to close in 2022. Blue Flint uses waste steam from Coal Creek as the energy for the refining process. Blue Flint was recently awarded $155,000 from the state's Agricultural Products Utilization Commission to conduct research and a feasibility study to use biomass as its fuel source.
We've been looking at a multitude of technologies and a multitude of fuel options as we look to repower the facility and bring utilities in to extend the life of the asset.
Jeff Zuger is the CEO of Midwest Ag Energy, which owns the Blue Flint plant.
The work that we did around biomass, primarily wheat straws, grain straws, and maybe to a lesser extent corn stover, you know, certainly indicates that there's enough biomass in the region around Underwood to support fueling our facility from a thermal needs perspective.
Zuger says the company is also looking at natural gas as a potential fuel source. He says Midwest Ag Energy hopes to have a decision by October.
Based on the APUC grant, we're moving ahead with more detailed engineering design and analysis on that to understand the capital and the technologies so that we can make a decision around whether or not biomass will be part of our future or we move ahead with natural gas.
Zuger says he's very optimistic over the future of Blue Flint.
From the capacity to bring in natural gas, to bring water supply, to provide the technology that continues to allow us to remain a low-carbon fuel producer, all looks very favorable. So I would say that the likelihood that we'll go ahead with the repower is very high, but ultimately that's the board's decision.
Midwest Ag Energy also owns the Dakota Spirit ethanol plant in Spiritwood. And Fargo Mayor Tim Mahoney says last Monday's directive approved by city leaders that encourages people to wear face masks in public will be back before city commissioners at next week's city commission meeting. The mayor says clarification and public input is needed.
So what we'd like to do is bring it back for a more thorough discussion of the item. I think there's some confusion at what the motion was exactly. So I've asked Eric Johnson to redraft what we would think would be a reasonable directive and then also to allow for a public input on that particular issue. So what we'd like to bring it up as a majority vote, I can ask to bring it back so the commissioners can get more input.
Mahoney says prior to last week's decision, he and commissioners were inundated with emails split about 50-50 for and against the mass directive for a variety of reasons. Some argued science, some argued politics. Fargo's master directive is not mandatory, as is the case in Minnesota. Commissioners did approve a mandate requiring masks be worn on city buses, which took effect today. Another mandate requires masks to be worn in city buildings and for some city business. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The federal government has paid billions of dollars to keep agricultural producers and the food chain running. The assistance has included direct payments to commodity farmers and cattle ranchers. But as Harvest Public Media's Dana Cronin reports, a lot of other farmers were left out of the big plan and didn't see those benefits.
When you walk into Cindy Ash's barn, one of the first things you notice, besides the sheep, is a huge burlap sack practically bursting at the seams with wool.
If you look at that big bag right there, we're sitting on about 600 pounds of wool from when they were sheared last, and it's been sitting there since they were sheared in March.
Ash runs Jubilee Farms in Clinton, Illinois, where she grows fruits and vegetables and raises sheep for wool to be turned into yarn. But not many people are buying premium yarn in this economy. Not to mention, the mill only recently reopened.
But there's really no point in us paying thousands of dollars to process wool that we can't move right now. So, which is part of what the CFAP was hoping to help with.
CFAP, that stands for Coronavirus Food Assistance Program, and is run by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. It's meant to bolster the food supply chain, in part by providing $16 billion in direct payments to farmers and ranchers. But it hasn't been helpful to farmers like Cindy Ash.
It doesn't seem like the program was designed for produce farmers. It seems like the program was really designed for corn and soybean or large livestock producers, and we don't do any of that.
In addition to wool, Ash usually sells produce at the local farmers market, which was closed this year due to the coronavirus. So she was hopeful until she opened up the assistance application, which requires you to list each crop you grow and an estimated loss.
If you're listing every crop that you weren't able to sell at a farmer's market this year, you literally, it depends how big your farm is and how much you're growing, but you could have hundreds of crops here to list.
The USDA recently added to their list of eligible crops, but some of the items Ash sells still don't qualify, including things like eggs. And for those that do qualify, USDA pays wholesale commodity prices. Usually, Ash says she could sell the wool in her barn for about $10,000. USDA would only compensate her about $200. Sanaz Arjemand is the federal policy director for the National Young Farmers Coalition. She represents a lot of specialty crop growers.
The details of how it's laid out make it hard for them to see an amount of funding coming out of the program that really covers what they need for the time that they'd have to put in to calculate all of those things and have all the paperwork to back it up.
In 2018, specialty crops accounted for about a quarter of all U.S. crop receipts. But as of late July, specialty growers received only 3% of total payments. The vast majority has gone to large livestock, dairy, and corn and soybean producers. USDA's Farm Service Agency Administrator Richard Fordyce says it's a matter of timing. That is, he says the program is based on losses incurred between January and April.
That was not really a time when we saw, you know, every state would have had specialty crop production happening at that time. So I think that's one reason why we're seeing a little smaller percentage.
Recently, lawmakers sent a letter to Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue asking him to include more small produce farmers in the program by basing it on total losses rather than on individual crops. But Fordyce says that would fail to give a full picture of what's happening on a farm. Cindy Ash says farmers like her are often overlooked by the USDA.
I would say that not just this year, but overall, they need to pay much more attention to diverse farmers, produce farmers, people that are doing something other than traditional ag like corn, beans, and large livestock.
She says it's more than likely she'll take a loss this year, a year she'd hoped to help her community get through the pandemic by providing healthy local food. I'm Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that looks at farm and rural issues. You can follow the reporting at harvestpublicmedia.org. Next on Main Street, parenting in a pandemic.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative. Touchstone Energy Cooperatives comprise a nationwide network of over 730 consumer-owned electric cooperative utilities dedicated to community, integrity, accountability, and innovation. The Greater North Dakota Chamber's 9th Annual Policy Summit will be hosted virtually online this year from August 25th through the 27th. This series of five crucial conversations facing North Dakota today include reigniting the economy, occupational licensure, North Dakota's future energy plans, the path for North Dakota's hospitality industry, and crisis leadership moderated by Governor Doug Burgum. Registration for the Greater North Dakota Chamber's Policy Summit is available online now for individual sessions or for the entire series at ndchamber.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Terry Burns with Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota. She is the team lead for Project Renew, and we're going to talk about one of those project pieces in just a couple of minutes. Terry, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's get some groundwork here first. How has the COVID-19 pandemic affected the operations and services provided by Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota?
Well, it's changed pretty much everything. Most of our programs are still being operated mostly virtually. And of course, we have such a wide variety of programs that it's affected them all a little bit differently. We are slowly starting to move back towards in-person operations, but of course, with things being so variable and changing so frequently, our team are having to make decisions essentially on a week-by-week basis.
Now, you offer a wide range of services. Can you give us a sense of which ones might have been particularly affected by this disruption?
Well, all of them have been affected in one way or another. We have, of course, everything from our housing programs all the way through to early childhood development, elder care services, mental health services. Pretty much any of our program areas that have in-person contact, which would be most of them really, have had to adapt in one way or another. And we've been fortunate that we have the infrastructure where a lot of things were able to go virtual. I'm just grateful that we were able to do that, but it is a challenge going virtual, of course.
If people need your help, how do they access it?
If they need our help, they can certainly give us a call. The best number to call would be the 701-223-1510, which gets you to Leslie, who's our wonderful coordinator in the Bismarck office. And otherwise, they can check out our website, which would be lssnd.org, where there are online submission forms where you can type in kind of what's going on and we'll get you to the right place.
Now, are your services generally free, regardless of income?
A lot of our services are generally free. Some of our therapy services programs are billable to insurance. So our outpatient mental health service, we would typically bill through insurance, but we do have sliding scales for most of our programs, depending on income levels, for people who don't have health insurance.
Now, you are the team lead for Project Renew. What is Project Renew?
Project Renew is a collaboration between the state of North Dakota and Lutheran Social Services. We were funded by grants from FEMA and SAMHSA. The funds were released in relation to the COVID-19 pandemic. Some listeners might be familiar with Project Renew. It's been used previously for flooding, especially in the Grand Forks and Fargo areas over the last 10 years. And in this case, COVID-19 was declared a disaster by the federal government and the funding was made available. What we are doing is providing free confidential crisis counseling support outreach to anyone who's been impacted in any way by COVID-19. So, of course, we've all been impacted at least in one way or another. So it can be anything from, of course, illness in your loved one, losing a family member, all the way down to just feeling a little bit isolated because your routines have been disrupted. We can handle the grand spectrum of things.
So it's a matter of calling and identifying that you're interested in getting some help, and perhaps that would come from Project Renew. And how would these services be delivered since you're largely not doing face-to-face? Is it over the phone? Is it some other technology? Or?
Primarily done over the phone. We decided that over the phone was probably going to be the most accessible form for most people. So even if you just have a landline, we can reach you. There's no need for a video service or anything like that. We'll ask you what time of day that you're available, and one of our crisis counselors will give you a call at the time that you identify as the best time of day for you.
Now, we're going to talk about the Parenting in a Pandemic program. I understand that the first one is due to be offered tomorrow, but you filled that one up pretty quickly. What is covered in this Parenting in a Pandemic program?
So the inspiration came from social media. I was scrolling through my social media late one night and kept seeing these big questions coming up about, are kids going to be permanently impacted by the pandemic? Can I send my kids back to school or daycare? I have two little kids of my own. So these are all things that have been rolling through my head over the past few months. And I saw, oh my goodness, we need to have these conversations with professionals. So the Parenting in the Pandemic program is structured really loosely because there are so many huge questions that parents are facing right now. So we want parents to be able to come in and talk about anything that is really impacting them. So it can be everything from, I don't know if I'm comfortable sending my kids back to school, to I'm struggling to work from home with little kids, to I'm worried that my children's mental health is suffering. And it can be absolutely anything. We want it to be an empathetic, open space for parents to talk about what they've been going through. And it doesn't have to be the negatives. I mean, it's been a stressful few months, but there's also been good things that have come out of this as well. And be able to talk about it with experts who are also living through this pandemic, most of whom also have children and are dealing with the same kinds of things.
So it's an online open-ended discussion. It's scheduled for tomorrow evening from 6:30 to 8. And as I mentioned, this session tomorrow has already been filled, but you're offering another one. I think that's August 13th.
Yes, August 13th from 6:30 to 8 as well. We were delighted by how quickly tomorrow's filled up. I think it filled up in about 48 hours. So we scheduled another one immediately because clearly there is some demand for people to need to talk about what they've been dealing with over the past 4 or 5 months now.
How many can you accommodate in one of these sessions, since you want to have this interactive discussion format?
Yes, we capped it at 15 participants per session. We wanted the group to be intimate enough that people feel comfortable sharing, but large enough to foster a vibrant discussion, and 15 seemed to be a good spot for that.
Now, if you go to that website, lssnd.org, at the top there are banners of various topics, and you can see Project Renew is up there. Who will present the concerns? By that, I mean, who is going to represent the sort of the Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota end of the discussion? Who are your pros?
So tomorrow's event is being facilitated by myself, and we have three of our crisis counselors will be participating as well as facilitators. So we have Katie Kruger, who in her day job is an outpatient therapist with Abound Counseling. She has decades of experience working with children and families, particularly children with behavioral issues. Jennifer Bockel, who is also an outpatient therapist with Abound. Jennifer has a PhD in social work and has focused really extensively on children through her career. She also has 2 school-age children, so she's been dealing with the same kind of worries and concerns as a lot of parents with regarding school decisions. And we have Sarah Wicks, who is also an Abound therapist. Sarah has focused a lot on maternal mental health through her career, as well as farm stress in rural communities. And she's a mom of 3. So we have a good range of personal and professional experience that we're bringing to the table here.
And you're dealing with a couple of conundrums here. Back to school concerns would be one. Obviously, every district has its own plan, and we've heard a few of them. We've had them on our show, yeah. Main Street. But the concern is there will be parents who simply don't want to put their children in that kind of environment right now. And so they'll want to homeschool. Will there be sort of guidelines or suggestions for how to proceed if you're interested in that option?
Well, we're not educators, so of course we don't want to dip our toes too deeply into that. But what we are wanting to do is we want to make people feel okay about making the decisions that are right for their family and right for their mental health. And you're absolutely right. Not everyone is going to be okay with sending their kids back to school. And some people will be absolutely fine with it. And what we want to stress is that making the decision that is right for your family is the right decision. Because in this situation, there isn't one easy answer for any of these big questions, really.
Has the pandemic affected childcare resources? I'm thinking maybe in some cases the parents are home, so they're home there with them, and maybe that complicates the parents' at-home work life if they are still employed. But we look at the school year coming up. Typically, when my kids were younger, and that's a long time ago now, that was daycare too. You know, you were sending them off from 8 in the morning until 4 or so in the afternoon, and somebody else was taking care of them. So how would you describe that circumstance right now? Are those resources there? They've always been stressed, it seems to me.
Yes, and this is actually very personal for me. I have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, so the daycare conundrum has been weighing heavily on my end. I can certainly assure you, last year, if you had told me that I would be muting my meeting to help potty train my 2-year-old, I would have laughed in your face. But this was my experience earlier this year. Daycares have been doing a wonderful job staying open. I know a lot of daycares stayed open through the pandemic, and I know that a lot of childcare workers were very nervous about it, but mostly were able to stay open for essential workers because, of course, not everyone has the choice to stay home. But they are stressed at the moment, and especially trying to implement some of the state guidelines for childcare. I know it is a huge stressor for childcare workers. And of course, parents are dealing with the same kind of decisions about feeling like it might not be safe to send their kids back yet. It's definitely a concern that I know a lot of my team are feeling personally, including myself.
Well, healthcare professionals nationally are referring to what's happening across the country, including here, as not outbreak so much as a kind of a forest fire that just continues to spread. So there's this sort of Damocles that's hanging over every family that's got kids either going to school or kids at home about what if. So stress and mental stress is a very real thing right now. What kinds of help can these counselors, can you offer for people who are really feeling like, you know, tomorrow everything could just change for the worse?
Yeah, absolutely. And we are coming in with an arsenal of self-care and coping skills education. We've been spending quite a bit of time compiling different tools that can be used both for children and adults, because of course, while the parents are stressed, the children are also experiencing the stress in the home as well. And parents will also be offered the chance to connect individually with counselors as well. I know with the individual contact, sometimes people feel like, oh, well, it's just a little bit of stress, or, oh, I don't have it that bad. And of course, these group discussions are a great way of saying that maybe it is worth checking in with someone on a one-on-one basis as well. So that's definitely something that we can offer too, which is exciting. But we'll be sharing all sorts of advice on stress management and trying to build up resilience and healthy coping skills within the family.
Terry Burns is the team lead for Project Renew, and we're talking about the upcoming Parenting in a Pandemic sessions. The first one is tomorrow. It's full. There's another one scheduled for August 13th. You can find more about that at lssnd.org. Terry, you mentioned that the idea for this online Zoom session, because that's the technology I guess you'll be using, was a reflection of the kinds of inquiries, the things you were seeing online. So when this discussion takes place tomorrow night, will you be noting the questions that are being asked to maybe help design the next discussion?
Yeah, absolutely. What I'm hoping to do with, especially with this first one, this is kind of us dipping our toes in a little bit, but the sorts of things that we're going to be seeing, the themes that we're going to be seeing come up are definitely going to be helping us target our outreach going forward, and potentially looking into more focused sessions and continuing this as a series, because of course, this isn't just a one and done type of thing. We're going to be dealing with this for weeks and months, potentially.
Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota has been around for a very long time. It does all kinds of different things, from refugee resettlement to these kinds of things we've been talking about. And I know that there is some insurance funding, you mentioned that, for certain kinds of counseling sessions that are covered by people's health insurance. How is Project Renew funded?
It is funded by grants. So all of the services that we are offering are completely free to citizens of the state. We are funded by FEMA, which is, of course, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Agency. So we are federally funded.
Is there a limiting factor? I mean, are you concerned about having enough to continue this kind of discussion?
No, we are. We've been very fortunate in this case that the grant funding has been wonderful. We feel pretty good about our ability to continue the services for as long as they're needed.
Well, I appreciate you sharing this information with our listeners. Again, this is Terry Burns. She's with Lutheran Social Services in North Dakota. She's the team lead for Project Renew, and we're talking about these upcoming online discussions for parents who've got some dilemmas that they're facing and some stress, perhaps. Parenting in a Pandemic. You can find out more by going online. Terry, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Doug.
More Main Street in a moment.
A new NPR Ipsos poll reveals what Americans make of the federal response to the pandemic.
As they grapple with just how grave the situation is, I think they're looking for sweeping, really broad, powerful action here.
From school openings to mask requirements and a new relief package, how all of that might affect the November election on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 3rd. On this date in 1906, many North Dakotans were looking forward to August holidays. Many of them were hunting, hiking, camping, and enjoying cookouts at Lake Metegoshi. An article in the Botno Courant shared the pleasure of summer at the lake nestled in the scenic Turtle Mountains. A newlywed couple enjoyed their new residence. Jack McKay paddled his canoe. He was so charmed by his surroundings that he began planning the construction of a new home. Mrs. Jefferson and her daughters were also enchanted with lake life and decided to buy a lot so they could build a home. J.F. Haskell sailed his boat, christened Metegoshi. There were dinners, dances, band concerts, and moonlight excursions on the schooner Washougum. Some land speculators from Illinois took a break from business to take in the sights around the lake. Lake Metegoshi is located 14 miles north of Botno on the Canadian border. The name derives from an Ojibwe phrase meaning Clearwater Lake of Scrub Oaks. The area was home to the Ojibwe, Blackfoot, Hidatsa, and Assiniboine people. The lake had long been a summer destination, and it was noted as a vacation spot even in the 1880s. In 1895, the Botno Courant listed the pleasures of the lake, including camping, parties, and musical events. The Lakeview Hotel offered an alternative to camping. The newspaper noted that everyone who stayed at the hotel was impressed with the accommodations. In 1934, WPA workers built a lodge, roads, and a recreation building that could hold 200 people. The area was formally designated as a state park in 1937. A stone near the entrance inscribed WPA 1938 commemorates those who worked on the park. Summer activities there today would be familiar to those who enjoyed the area in the 1800s. Swimming, canoeing, camping, and biking. Fishermen can try their luck catching pike, walleye, and perch. But the park isn't just for the summer. Winter visitors enjoy snowmobiling, ice fishing, sledding, and cross-country skiing. The Turtle Mountains Outdoor Learning Center offers programs on ecology and conservation. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. Tuesday on our show, we'll talk with Andrew Skugman, Executive Director of the Minnesota Police Chiefs Association, about police training and initiatives to address policing policies in the wake of the unrest that began with George Floyd's death during an arrest by Minneapolis police officers. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.